Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. And this is my co-host and colleague, Sam.
Sam Wong here, professor of neuroscience and molecular biology and founder of the Princeton Election Consortium.
So Sam, believe it or not, it's been a year since the election.
Seems like just a century ago.
It's been a real doozy. I was listening to, again, our podcast the morning after the election just to see what we were talking about. The big thing we talked about were the polls and what happened.
Yeah, great.
We also talked about whether he was going to be able to push a big legislative agenda.
I guess we found that out.
We found that out. I was more confident that he would and that the Republicans would be able to work with him. We didn't talk about Russia.
Did I express an opinion about the legislative agenda?
You were dubious.
Yeah, well.
We didn't talk about Russia. We didn't talk about the fake news. And we were more focused on how it happened than what was about to happen. So it was kind of interesting. I mean, one of the issues we were discussing was how much he reflects where the Republican Party had gone and if he would be the new face of the party.
Ah, duh. Tovarish Trump is new voice of Republican Party.
All right. So you just brought everything together. Anyway, so we've had a lot that we have discussed from the investigation into Russia to the approval ratings of the president to the failed legislative front so far to Charlottesville and white extremism and its connection to the administration and more. So I think it's fair to say it's been crazy, shocking, chaotic. We can debate if it's unprecedented or not. I think that's a discussion many people are having. But why don't we just start off today talking about some of the polls? So several polls have caught my attention in the last few days. The one, I think it was from the Washington Post, showed that his approval ratings are the lowest at this point in the presidency, 9 months in, as any president since the polling began.
Right.
Those polls also showed that most people have confidence in the Mueller investigation, and a large number think Trump might have committed a crime or is guilty of something. Also, his support with independents, which you've talked about for a while now, is not doing well and is slipping. There was another poll out from the Wall Street Journal that talked about the Trump counties and indicated that even though there's still strong support from Trump's base people, which in my mind isn't really much of a breaking news story, that the base still loves the president, is some softening.
The baser they are, the more they like him.
The baser they are. But there was some softening and some indication they don't think things are necessarily better now than they were a year ago. And finally, there was another poll that came out a couple days ago that when asked between a Democratic and Republican a candidate for the midterms, by the largest margins, I think, in a decade, people prefer the Democrat over the Republican. Again, that's right. Not naming anyone. That's just in general. So we do have this burst of polls in the last week suggesting it's not all rosy for President Trump, despite what everyone thinks.
Not all rosy. So now that is like saying that things are not all rosy for the Republican Party and for Donald Trump is an understatement.
Well, I'll tell you why. Let me just back up. I'll tell you why I say it. Often I have these discussions. I'll have these discussions with people, and I will be the more critical person. Yeah. All this stuff is going wrong. This is definitely not a successful presidency. And people love to throw back, well, Republicans still generally like him. The base loves him. And so what's going to happen? So
okay, but come on. But like the Democrats mostly like Hillary Clinton. I mean, like, you know, you hear all this like wanking about Donna Brazile or whatever, but in all these cases, I would say every single one of these data points, you have to say compared with what. Okay, and so let's go backwards. So you cited a whole bunch of interesting stuff there, but we can kind of take these one by one. Republican voters overwhelmingly like Donald Trump. So, you know, that depends on which ones. So the ones who are self-styled most conservatives like him, if I recall correctly, 83% of them like him. The ones who are more business or persuadable, I don't know, business Republicans or non-ideological Republicans, they only like him to the tune of about 60%. And so I think that one difficulty with reading numbers and reading data is that you have to think to yourself, compared with what? What if you just had some president in of either party in the last, what, 3-4 administrations? Of course that president is going to enjoy close to typically 90% approval from his or her own party.
Yes.
Or I guess now we can say his anyway, but his own party. And so for a president to be anywhere below 90% among his own partisan loyalists is actually pretty bad. And so for Trump to be at 80% or what have you among Republican voters, well, Republican voters are only these days about 35% of all voters. And so for him to get 80% of those, I mean, that's about 26%.
Yeah.
And so I think it's compared with what? So sure, his own partisans are sticking with him. And that has implications for, say, the primaries next year. It means that Republicans who would like to stay in office are sticking with him. And there's this really strong pattern where our number of samples now is in on the side of elected officials is, of course, hundreds or thousands.
Yeah.
On the side of people who are leaving office is now, you know, in the neighborhood of a dozen. But the pattern is that if those who are never facing election again on the Republican side speak their mind, that is not very favorable to Trump. Those who wish that have some expressed wish to be reelected next year in 2018, they're sticking with him. And so the consequence of that is not that he's doing fine. The consequence is that he is a boulder tied to the Republican Party, and they can't cut him loose because their base voters like the guy. So, yeah. He's doing fine among Republicans, but that is, right. You know, that's a real ominous thing, I think, for his loyalists.
Yeah. So what does that
for
mean?
His side?
So you read, you see all these, and okay, compared to what? Right. And if you compare it, it's not so great.
Right. So let me. So
what does that mean?
So here's an example. So a reporter contacted me yesterday.
Yeah.
Looking at the Real Clear Politics approved disapproved number for Trump, and you cited one number, and it is true that. So he said Donald Trump's approval and disapproval numbers are about where they were before the election last year. So it could be argued that he's doing fine. Maybe he's even doing a little bit better. And so the question there is compared to what? Because during last year's campaign, the really salient characteristic was that Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton were both unpopular. Trump is the most unpopular major party candidate ever in the history of polling in the last 50 years. Hillary Clinton also unpopular, but that's a general trend in the unpopularity of major party candidates. Presidents who get elected get some bonus in popularity after they get elected. Donald Trump's bonus was relatively small, and he's only declined since. And so compared with what? The right comparison for where he's at now is against all other presidents in their first year of office, and he's, by a reasonably healthy margin, the least popular first-year president in the history of polling. So he's not doing well at all. He's like he is a giant boulder tied around the fortunes of his party. Now, getting back to another thing that you pointed out, which is House generic preference.
Yeah.
That's an interesting one to watch. It's hard to tell because we're a year out from next year's election and things can move. Just for example, if you looked at, say, I mean, just to get back to presidential approval, George W. Bush's approval in the first week of September 2001 and the third week of September 2001 was very different because of September 11th. That man's approved-disapproved number jumped by like a net of 90 points. Mm. Okay, that guy became super popular as the country rallied around him. So, you know, if something crazy happens in North Korea or in Saudi Arabia or what have you, things could change. But back to the data points, yeah, the House generic ballot is not Republicans don't want it where it is now. The median of the last four polls is Democrats up by 8 percentage points. That's probably, but not definitely enough to flip control of the House. But it's soft, right? Because we've got a year till the election.
Yeah.
And if you look at those last four polls, 15% of voters express being undecided. That's the median of those four polls. And, you know, 15% undecided could go either way. Now, generally speaking, it's not so clear what force would cause them to migrate back towards the Republicans, but a D plus 8 advantage is not a real great thing. Now, on the other hand, again, things could change. Let's say there's a house cleaning in the White House. Everyone who is in the crosshairs of Robert Mueller and the investigation either leaves or is indicted or maybe even convicted. let's say that that people who are standard issue government officials get put into place, I don't know, it could become a more of a normal administration. I mean, I don't think there's any indication that such a thing would happen.
Right.
But, you know, you could imagine such a thing happening. So I'm just saying that every indicator is pointing. Now, the one indicator that is pointing.
And turnout will matter. Right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, so the one indicator I think that's pointing in a generically good direction is that the economy seems to be doing okay.
Yeah.
That stock markets are doing well. Business indicators are doing okay. And so the peculiarity about all this is that all these indicators are really headed south for the incumbent party that controls the presidency and Congress. And yet the economy seems to be doing all right. And so there's this weird disconnect. And, you know, one possible answer is a pretty conspicuous lack of achievement and a pretty conspicuous cloud of corruption and, you know, possible treason. These are negatives.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. I mean, it's hard to imagine any kind of change like you're talking about. I can't imagine him cleaning house, but more importantly, it starts with him.
But it's weird, right? Because at some level, I think that what we're seeing here, I feel like there aren't, you know, a year ago, it felt like laws of political gravity had been, you know, of political nature had been broken, that everything we knew was false about politics, then had to be re-questioned. And I don't think that now.
What do you mean?
Well, for instance, all the data currently point against the Republicans right now. And so one could say, yes, but the polls were wrong in the case of Trump versus Clinton, and so therefore we should ignore data. That would be a really bad conclusion to reach. There was a polling failure. It was concentrated in the Midwest. And because people are spooked by that, look, you know, I made a polling, you know, I made an analytical error. But to reject all empirical data is weird. I think that most of what we've seen in the last year can be explained as follows. A Republican Party that's been getting from its voters becoming more and more separated from the other 65-70% of American voters. Parties on both sides getting weaker, which opens the possibility of a party being pulled by extremes. And a Republican Party that has gotten to places that are pretty far from the mainstream, and they finally got a candidate to their liking.
Yeah.
And now the Republican Party is kind of, in terms of national politics, is broken in ways that could let them still win elections, but doesn't let them recognize when there is a crisis in their midst. Because what they have right now is they have a crisis in their midst, right?
Yeah.
Like Donald Trump is
right.
Big trouble.
Yeah.
They'd be better off with Mike Pence as president.
Yes.
They'd probably be able to get a tax agenda through.
Absolutely.
They'd have better control over cabinet agencies. They would be better able to do whatever it is they want to do with education or the Affordable Care Act or what have you. From a policy standpoint, they could not possibly be worse off than the guy they have now as president. And yet, you know, the base likes the guy, as you said.
Right.
And so they don't want to get rid of him, or they can't get rid of him. Isn't that weird?
No, it's very weird. I mean, but you have to add in the story incompetence too. I mean, Trump has been monumentally incompetent in handling the job. And I mean that in terms of handling legislation.
Right.
He still should have gotten much more, even if the country, even if the party is to the far right of where a lot of the country is. Some of this is pure presidential mismanagement. We never talked about his tweets.
Right.
So it's funny. Like, that wasn't an issue we were discussing. He tweeted in the campaign, but we didn't think that would be a story of this presidency how that affects his
ability. So these things get amplified by the monumentality of the office itself.
Yeah.
So I said that presidents typically get more popular as president than as candidate. Presidents typically start acting more presidential. They use the trappings of the office to project soft power, to make proclamations, to engage in negotiations with the other two, with the legislative branch of government. And what's he doing? He's using Twitter, and it seems to be an outlet for venting about things he can't get as president, right? Like Josh Marshall was saying on Talking Points.
Opponent.
Yeah, Josh Marshall was pointing out on Talking Points memo that Trump's tweets have gotten more extreme and more inflammatory, and it appears to correlate with the fact that he's not getting things legislatively and he's not getting policies that he wants. And so what he does is says things that, were they to come true, sound authoritarian. Like, you would think that it would be frightening to have a president say, I wish I could use the Department of Justice to go after the Democrats.
Yeah.
Okay, so just under normal circumstances, if you were to read me a headline, let's go back a year. Okay, let's go back to us a year ago.
Yeah, yeah.
If someone had come from the future and said, President Trump has said he wishes he could use the DOJ to go after political enemies, our hair would be on fire. Okay, yeah. It would be terrifying. But I have to say, when he said that, this is going to sound terrible, but my first reaction was to chortle and say, yeah, right, you wish. Who the hell's going to do that? Like, Sessions has his own problems. And what career official at the DOJ is going to go after like some BS story about Uranium One and Hillary Clinton on your say-so? Like, that's career suicide. I mean, maybe they'll make you happy for a week, dude. But
right.
after that.
Kind of like a kid who's, put in his or her room after misbehaving and yelling and screaming. But
when I am in charge, you're going to bed without dinner. You're the puppet. You're the one who's in bed with the Russians.
There's an element.
I hate you.
Right.
I guess that's more than 140
characters. No, there's
characters.
An element to that.
Yeah,
right.
That's too many characters.
Right.
Hey, you know, I still think they should give him more than 140 characters.
Just to hear everything on his mind.
Just give him 280. Hell, right. Just give him 10,000. Right. Just write a tweet today.
All right. Let's turn to another issue. So thinking about the whole year. So I wrote something in CNN that's like one of these lists of shocking things.
13 shocking things.
I just sat down and just remembered. You forget after a while all the different events. And, I went through he said in November already he was telling everyone that he won the popular election and this massive voting fraud was hiding things. We obviously had the wiretapping claim about President Obama, the firing of Comey, the Charlottesville, even smaller things like the Mika Brzezinski tweet, which in retrospect, it's hard to read that again.
So all this happens
in a year.
Yeah.
And then I just want to read. So Michelle Goldberg wrote this article in the New York Times. She's obviously a critic of the president. And she says, the country has changed in the past year, and many of us have grown numb after unrelenting shocks. What now passes for ordinary would have once been inconceivable. The government is under the control, she writes, of an erratic racist who engages in nuclear brinkmanship on Twitter. He is dismantling the State Department, defending the hollowing of the diplomatic corps by saying on Fox News, I'm the only one who that matters. And she goes on and says he publicly pressures the Justice Department to investigate his political opponents. He's called for reporters to be jailed. And she goes through everything and talks basically about, in some ways, how he's changed the normal.
Okay, I have to contest that. So the presidency is under the control. Okay, stop there. The presidency is – I mean, there are ways in which – right. It is interesting that the State Department is understaffed, that many high-level positions are going unfilled. And that's interesting. But the action that is achieved, as far as I can tell – and it would be really interesting to – my impression reading among Republican commentators and conservative commentators is that the broad feeling is that he's not in control. And so the things that are accomplished are negative in nature – in the sense that there's a failure to fill positions of the State Department. There's a failure to use the levers of power. And there are ways in which levers of power are being used. So there are certain limits being placed on, say, open enrollment under the Affordable Care Act, right? Open enrollment has been shortened from 8 weeks to 6 weeks. Publicity efforts have been curtailed. And so there are things that are being done, but they're mostly negative in nature. And there's a sense in which it's the absence of action. And so I would push back on what she's saying there by saying that, yes, the public conversation has been degraded. I can't, it's much harder to talk to children about politics now, right? Because, at schools, if you walk through an elementary school, there'll be like these portraits of all the presidents.
Yeah.
And then the last one just really the last one, it's like this guy who talks about I mean, I can't even now, a year later, I can't repeat some of these insults that he utters against veterans, against women, against people who are not white skinned. And, a president who expresses sympathy for shooting victims in Texas, but not in New York City, right? And it's just hard. The public conversation has gotten degraded in ways that I think we're
not. But that's intentional. Meaning he wants that. This is the kind of conversation he wants. What you see as degraded. he sees as more honest. He sees as putting issues on the table that no one will talk about. And I mean, that is a form of – that's part of what presidents do. It's not just legislation. Yes. It's what they say and how they shape the conversation. So you could read Michelle Goldberg and what you're saying and say he's done a lot in that way.
But I would say looking at her piece and looking at your piece on CNN with your 13 shocking items, my counter to that is think of the whole thing as a stress test to the American system. Mm-hmm. What the foreign policy writer Tom Ricks has said, it's effectively a decapitation strike against the American government. Yeah. Imagine that you still have a judicial branch. Imagine that you still have a legislative branch, although they're not doing so great right now. And just imagine if the head of state is removed from office. We didn't have a head of state. Instead, we just had some reality show host who got a hold of the president's communication channels. That's what we have. And so it's a stress test of what happens in such a circumstance. And I agree that there are some pretty shocking things that have happened. But other institutions still seem to be working. Yeah. I mean, look, there's an election happened there as of the broadcast of this podcast. Elections happened without seeming incident. We'll see if that turns out to be the case. But without seeming incident in New Jersey and Virginia, we're talking right now about polling in a semi-normal manner. The judicial branch may have some weird candidates coming in, but, you know, they're still functioning. A lot of things – look, I got my car registration renewed the other day, and that seemed to be working okay.
Right.
Okay, so it's not like everything's broken. It's that these certain channels are broken. What the president does is broken right now.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting to see what basically what happens. I've said it before. It's what happens when a random Fox News viewer gets put in control of the executive branch. Right?
Right, right. Well, that's fair to say. I mean, that's a very positive way. What would you say?
Well, here's saying the positive thing.
Well, it's funny. I gave a talk in Washington last week, and someone in the audience asked, I was with two other panelists, journalists, and they said they don't like the administration, the person asking the question, but they said, can you name one thing positive about what the president has done in the past year? What would you say?
Gorsuch. If I'm a conservative, the one positive thing is filling vacancies and judgeships.
But that's an accomplishment. Is there something positive that you could say?
Oh,
as
not a conservative.
Yeah.
Yeah, caved when Congress passed a budget, and so NIH's research budget went up 12%. And as a research scientist, that really relieved pressure on a system where there have been cuts for the last 5-10 years. And so through failure of – oh, that doesn't really count though because that goes against what the Trump administration wanted.
Right, right.
Let me think here.
It was a hard question. Everyone was quiet. And I was just thinking – the reason I ask about where a lot of the country is in terms of not his supporters but the rest of the country.
Right.
Is this a president where people just don't see any good, any light in this presidency? Or is it, I don't agree with some of the things he does, but I could see why people like him. Okay, how deep is the opposition in the rest of the country that poll is not indicating there's still support? What do you think?
I'm just
because that was the silence when that person asked the question. I had an answer. Yeah, it was also, I answered about people are more engaged in politics today than I can remember. Everyone has an opinion. Everyone's watching. Right. Everyone's following. You care about the issue.
So one thing that's happened.
So that's a good thing.
One thing that's happened in the years since. We're talking about the last 12 months. One thing that's happened is that people have come out of the woodwork, right? On the liberal side, the indivisible movement.
Right.
Right. On the conservative side, I mean, honestly, like white nationalists who go out and carry their torches and want to keep the secessionist.
That's probably better to have inactive.
I agree. I'm trying to do the isn't the journalism thing to say, well, on one side you've got liberals engaged as never before. On the other side you've got like right wing lunatics
You can argue there's conservatives who are more self conscious and talking about what does the movement mean.
Right. So I would say
that's
fissures
a good debate.
Among conservative intellectuals where they're having honest conversations, at least in the intellectual circles where people like whether it be Bill Kristol or Charlie Sykes
or David Frum
Evan McMullen. Like there are conversations on conservative circles about what it means to be Republican versus what it means to be conservative. And that's intellectually interesting. On the liberal side, people have come out of the woodwork, like real grassroots candidates. I mean, candidates up and down the ballot who are really interested in politics. Many women who previously were in some ways acting as normal citizens, so not actors in the process now coming and running for office. As we've talked about before, the Indivisible movement is very much powered by women all across the United States. I've seen it in our local community. It's interesting there, right? So people up and down the ballot. And we're about to see the first data points as of the release of this podcast. There'll be data on whether that's carrying the day, say, in Washington State, where it's possible that Democrats may gain control over the whole legislative and governorship. In New Jersey, Phil Murphy is almost certainly going to win
the
governorships. And Virginia. Which,
that's the big unknown.
Yeah. And we're recording this before the election. It's going to get released. Okay, guys, Northam by 3 points there. Okay, but, you know, maybe not, right?
Yeah.
Things could go either way because it's a close election. But Virginia is a case where that's a big election. Everyone's watching. But as I said, New Jersey and Washington State. And so we've seen in the last 12 months, down ticket Democrats performing quite well in special elections, generally speaking, performing a median of about 10, 15 points better than expected based on where the election was last November. And so there is some kind of mobilization, people talking actively about politics. And that's interesting to see.
Yeah.
Right.
It's like
the Watergate generation, right? Like there's a whole generation of new lawmakers,
right?
Like Henry Waxman and the whole gang who came in 1974. And that was really an interesting moment. Now, what came afterwards was more disruption. And so I think the counterargument to that is in the long arc of the next decade or so, what's happening to American politics?
Yeah. And what will happen if this investigation reveals things that really upset the electorate about how politics works? The Russia investigation.
Right.
And, it got in the last week since we've recorded, there's more. I can't remember if we recorded before the indictments, before the guilty plea, before Carter Page is basically saying, I went, I spoke. And I'm sure there's a lot more. Wilbur Ross, the story broke in the Times, which is pretty amazing story.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Right. I was not expecting Ross to be sucked in. That had escaped my attention. I think because there's so much chaff in the air right now. It's just such a target-rich environment of the soap opera of players who are constantly rotating in and out of the news, where we're watching Manafort or we're watching, whatever. We're wondering what happened to Roger Stone or what have you. And then there are these cabinet officials who I had assumed were just under the radar in the sense that they're just cabinet officials doing their job. But when Wilbur Ross comes out and becomes part of the story, we haven't really been hearing anything about Betsy DeVos.
Right.
Right? The education secretary. And her, she's like part of the family that started Blackwater.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So there are all these things that we're not hearing about because the big story is all the scandal and possible criminality in people close to the Trump campaign. And meanwhile, Wilbur Ross has some Russian connection?
Right, a big one.
Holy cats.
A big one.
Yeah.
Do you think this is an overblown story? That's what I was, that's the criticism. Is there too much attention paid to this? I don't think so.
It's hard to know because the thing is, a big story and a little story would probably start in the same way. So if a minor political figure from a campaign gets convicted or strikes a plea deal, that either is going to be more drip that's sort of not very interesting, or it's the beginning of going up a chain. So I was reading an interesting piece in Slate magazine that Mueller has created a mechanism in which even if he's fired as the special prosecutor, things can still go on without him because he appears to be working. He's leaving the situation open where he can collaborate with states like Eric Schneiderman, the New York Attorney General, and these things can go on without him. Right. So Manafort can still be prosecuted under New York state law and President Trump's pardon power cannot reach state crimes. And so there is, there is some question about where it's going to go. But I've seen speculations that at least there is wiggle room for it to continue and for these little crimes to be used to flip witnesses and to go after people.
This is
bigger
if he's
and
fired, if he's.
If, so,
he
yeah, so,
right.
so I'm
now,
saying
I
a couple
imagine.
Things. So I'm saying a couple things here. Well, the first thing I'm saying is the little things look like they're on a trajectory to become bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
The other thing I'm saying is that there appears to be evidence, indirect evidence, that the whole investigation is being set up in a way that it escapes the power of the president to cut it off by firing the man in charge of the investigation. So I'm saying that we actually are probably going to have an opportunity to find out whether it's going to get bigger and bigger.
In some ways, now that I'm thinking back, we probably could have anticipated a lot of what happened this year, not the details, but obviously campaign candidate Trump is basically the same person as the president. So unless we anticipated a change in personality, this was what you were going to get. I remember in the early part of the administration, it wasn't Russia. It was conflict of interest in general. That was the question, whether his business empire and how that related to his political empire, what this would all do when he refused to create a firewall. And that's part of the story of Russia isn't about collusion in an election. It's really about all these economic ties.
Yeah. What if this ends up turning into, say, reopening the subject of money laundering by Trump's casinos, which is likely to—
Or his real estate owners.
Yeah. And there are Russian connections there. So if this turns into Russian financial connections where they've been propping him up for the last 10, 20 years—
Yeah.
And that's the thing he was hiding in his tax returns. And it turns out that he, in fact, is a Russian puppet.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Like, is it, you know, is it criminal? Well, I mean, I guess we'll find out whether it's criminal. It's sort of, you know, that like that. I think that's the kind of question that gets left open.
So the one thing we didn't anticipate, you might have more than I did, and it's a question related to our ongoing conversation, is this issue, which we've now talked about today, but— Why didn't partisanship work legislatively? And so partisanship worked in the election. Partisanship has worked in the polling still, generally. Yeah. But the one place it didn't translate, United Government did not bring legislation. And I guess the question I have thinking about today's conversation, how much of this is the president and his chaos and I would argue incompetence in handling these issues, how much is cooked into what the Republican Party is? Do they have an agenda that's not actually governable at this point?
Well, I mean, campaigning is a game of emotions and messaging, and the American media is a little bit low on fact-checking, a little bit low on self-restraint. It's got a certain Trumpiness to it where the shiny object of the week becomes the big shiny object. And I think that Republicans broadly, look, they're good campaigners. They're good at appealing to emotions. They're good at like finding issues and turning them to advantage. And these are people who are good campaigners, I think, anyway. But when it comes to governing is boring. It involves listening. It involves forming coalitions. It involves peeling off one or two key votes. I think that had Mike Pence been president for the last 10 months, surely some kind of deal could have been struck to bring Senator Manchin from West Virginia on board, or something to not annoy Susan Collins from Maine, or something to make John McCain think that regular order had been obeyed. Like surely some modification or partial repeal or something with the Affordable Care Act was legislatively possible, but it involved peeling off Democrats. It involved not ticking off one's own conference.
Yeah.
And, you know, the majorities that they have a decent majority in the House, but they have a bare majority in the Senate.
Right.
And they have not shown the craftsmanship. I mean, Democrats have all kinds of issues, but as far as I can tell, Democrats are in office in order to govern, and they want to pass laws, and they want to make the government run well.
I have to ask, what did you think of the whole Donna Brazile story?
Well, she said things that don't actually pass fact-checking, so I'm not sure it's necessary to have an opinion about that. I mean, look, if one of the dominant figures in Democratic Party politics for the last 20 years, who's amassed a huge fundraising advantage, who as of January of 2016 was the odds-on favorite for the nomination, if that person wants to have a say in how the Democratic Party is run, I'm just not detecting a scandal here.
And I agree.
Where is the scandal? And, you know, and as far as I can tell, my understanding is that she and Bernie Sanders signed very similar agreements with the DNC. The thing that I think is interesting there is that the Democratic National Committee is weak and is in financial trouble. And that gets back to the weakening of national parties, where the parties are weak because of campaign finance reform. And there's something going on there where power has devolved to individual donors and to PACs. Right. And so the interesting thing there, as far as I can tell, is that the DNC is pretty weak.
But some of that will be about President Obama, though. I mean,
yes. So President Obama
did not do much to reverse that as president.
You know, he was like there is a certain Carter-esque quality to that.
No, there is. But that's important because now this is like, you know, this is the following 4 years that you get.
Yeah. Right. So neglect from the incumbent president.
I think
for
it's
years.
A big story. Yeah. I think it will be a big part of looking back at his presidency.
Well, and so one thing is that as people talk, as fissures appear among people who are visible Democrats, right, like the Sanders people are out, like this grassroots activism, groups like Indivisible, there are these voices that are coming up, younger voices, and it'll be interesting to see how those younger voices interact with the current version of the DNC. And so it feels like there's going to be a lot of ferment on the Democratic side. I mean, feels to me like that's in the domain of normal politics.
Yeah.
But basically ferment and change as older players leave the stage.
So the funny thing is, after a year since the election, you're a little bit more optimistic than you were.
Optimistic about
meaning
what?
About the institutions working pretty well, like your driver's license renewal. a little more optimistic about the ability of different political opponents to stop some of his most extreme action, and a little bit more optimistic about the contained damage. That's what it sounds like that he'll inflict than you were right after the election when you sounded kind of
I would say that, look,
pretty
the,
down.
Look, the public conversation gets wearing. It's just tiring to have to worry about crazy things happening in the news, whether it be in North Korea or what have you.
Yeah.
So that's tiring, right?
Right.
But a lot of institutions have stayed the same. Like, look, American education, I think, is doing a pretty good job. I'm a scientist. The American scientific establishment is unparalleled in the world. Like, there's competition from Europe, but it's an enterprise where it's okay to have competition from another peace-loving entity such as Western Europe. And so that's a good thing. The judicial branch appears to be working, you know, I mean, one can argue about whether one likes the ideology of the judicial branch, but in some ways they're functioning pretty well.
And you've kind of normalized Trump, meaning not normalized, but this is the president. We'll move forward.
Well, okay, right. So the difficulty
Michelle
is
Goldberg's
like,
right.
Yeah. Well, as opposed to what? It's like Lord
Byron. Compared to what?
So Lord Byron said that that you couldn't – one couldn't lead a life of – passion unbridled all the time because one would kill oneself shaving in the morning. So he used a straight razor to shave. And he said, you just kill, if you had a passionate life, you would just die in the morning. And so at some level, the only response that is functional in the face of such a strange meltdown in one whole branch of government is to use the parts that are still working.
Yeah.
If your house is on fire, right?
That's
and so,
fair.
You know, you still have to go get the bucket brigade or what have you. And so, you know, it is weird to have. I would say the thing that has surprised me the most is that Trump and Pence and his cabinet have more or less stayed in place. I mean, you know, there have been staff rotations, but they're
it's generally the same. Yeah.
Trump's been in place for 12 months.
Yep.
And there have been a few characters who have left the stage, but things have changed less than one would expect. I mean, I don't know. On Saturday Night Live, there were jokes a year back in January about how Trump would be president for no more than a few months.
Right.
And so
the liberal fantasy.
I have to admit, well, no, I mean, maybe, but like, I actually think that if one is a liberal, then shouldn't one want Trump? I mean, the current alternative is Pence.
Right.
So actually, I would say that
you mean
look,
less effective you'd want if you're a liberal.
Yeah, at some level. I mean, I don't know, like. Yeah. Whatever the criminality and incompetence and other stuff is going on in the White House, I think a liberal might like to have Trump over Pence.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. Look, the things we're going to see now in the next few months, A, all these polls that we started our discussion, what do they translate into?
Yeah, we'll find out.
Does it actually affect the GOP? Does it affect him? Where does this investigation go? I think it's a pretty serious investigation now. And my guess is there's going to be a lot worse information to come out. This is probably just the beginning. So what does that all turn into? And then obviously starting the week this airs with Virginia, New Jersey, how does the electorate respond to all this?
Right.
And
so there's
do
more,
we see a change?
Right. More data points coming in real
big
soon.
Big ones. Big ones. And I think, you know, the Virginia is important. I'm not a big special election person.
Well,
but
the Virginia,
I think Virginia
one,
is.
And a lot of people who get elected this time will have a say in redistricting in 2021.
Right.
And so from a gerrymandering and redistricting
like
point of view,
Republicans
that's important.
Realized in 2020.
Right. Like, so there is the potential for Virginia to have, say, single party control of government. I mean, I rather doubt that it's going to happen, but because the Virginia State Senate is closely divided.
Yeah.
So that could go either way. But one can imagine single party control, and that would be very significant for the Republicans.
And if Gillespie wins in Virginia, Republicans will be feeling pretty good. I think. Even if it doesn't reveal what will happen in the midterms, it will feel as if all the problems that this boulder, as you said, of a presidency creates are not insurmountable and it'll energize people.
Trumpy messages without Trump himself.
Yeah. Right? Because no, that's what Bannon said.
That's what Gillespie is.
Yeah.
That's like Matt Bevin in Kentucky, the governor there.
Yeah.
Right? Trumpiness without Trump.
Right. And Steve Bannon said that's what this is. And if this works, he said, then the Democrats are in trouble. I don't really listen to Steve Bannon.
I guess it's Trumpism without Trumpiness. That would be the right word. Yeah. Trumpism without Trumpiness.
Right. Yeah. Or Trumpism without Trump himself.
Yeah, right.
Okay. Well, that's it for Politics and Polls. Thanks for joining us. And we'll be back next week.
Bye, everybody.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series produced by WooCast. This podcast is intended to be informational only and does not reflect nor represent the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.